Clinton's saying that he's going to increase the tax rate on the rich from the piddling amount, 31 or 32, up to 36, will still leave the tax rate on the rich very much below what it was in the early 80s, and just a fraction of what it was back in the 60s and 70s.
The answer is clear. The facts are clear. The answer is clear.
That's why I really believe.
And there's some really wild things that they've been doing in the states. For instance, in Texas, a fellow named Stephen Hoetze was elected as head of the GOP in that state. And he is associated with groups that want to Christianize America by taking over the government, beginning with city councils and county sheriff offices. Once in power, they want to establish county militias. And they also are gearing up in Texas to fight a future communistic Mexico that will march across the Rio Grande.
And we were told we could stand up and observe the bomb, which I did. And when I turned around and looked and I seen this explosion, which seemed like it was never ending the way it was growing.
A potpourri of several subjects, two U.S. presidents and their tax and energy bills, the religious riot in the United States, and nuclear testing and contamination. Right now, on Alternative Views. This is our 22nd potpourri of special reports and presentations. We will show you some videos by Tim Hamlin, Calvin Russell's This Is Your World, and one by the Emergency Broadcast Network, We Will Rock You, as well as a documentary called We Are All Downwinders by Maureen McGarry. But before we see these special features, here are some news stories from the Alternative Press.
I was looking back through an old spotlight and noticed a very juicy article in the August 31st edition. It talked about a report which had come out of the American Enterprise Institute, which was along the same line of a story with the spotlight it had previous to that. And to give some background and understanding on why the U.S. policy toward Yugoslavia or Serbia has been the way it is, you have to go back and look at Henry Kissinger and Associates, as we always do, you know. Instead of Cher La Femme, yeah, it's Cher David Rockefeller, and of course his little puppet, Henry Kissinger. Well, anyway, when Kissinger left the White House, of course, he set up Kissinger and Associates, and a high-price consulting firm in New York City. He brought into it none other than Lawrence Eagleburger and Brent Scowcroft, who eventually, you know, they went into the Bush administration. Then later, Eagleburger became Secretary of State, and Scowcroft was the National Security Advisor. Well, Eagleburger had been the U.S. Ambassador to Yugoslavia from 1977 to 1981. And he became very friendly with the leader there, Milosevic. Milosevic ordered the second largest bank, state bank under his control, to set up a U.S. subsidiary, and he hired Kissinger and Associates as its corporate consultants. And he made, who did he make as the on the board of directors? Well, Lawrence Eagleburger was the chairman, and Scowcroft was on the board. Now, as the Kissinger and Eagleburger, they made subsequently some real good business decisions as from their point of view, helping the Yugoslavs to develop the Yugo here, in the car in this country. However, the bank that they helped start, facilitated a branch here in this country, it was indicted and convicted and closed down for money laundering 2 years after it its opening. But Eagleburger and Scowcroft divided more than $1 million in consulting and director's fees between them. So then the final thing was, to bring it full circle, the study shows that Eagleburger and Scowcroft were backers of Milosevic all the way through, and Eagleburger even went so far as to suppress dissent of regional experts and career foreign service officers in the State Department who warned that the U.S. support for Milosevic would end in a bloodbath. And as we know, the U.S. has went real easy in supporting Milosevic and not having a really significant operations against him, either militarily or economically, and that is still going on.
It looks like the Clinton administration had some April Fool's surprises for the American consumers. In a meeting with Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen, business leaders, representatives of U.S. manufacturers, claimed that the proposed energy tax, which everyone would shoulder the burden of, would hurt their competition with overseas competitors and hurt the effort to create jobs in this country. Stanley Galt, for instance, the chief executive of Goodyear Tire and Rubber, said that, well, this energy tax is going to add so much money to the cost of making tires that it would hamper his company's efforts to compete against Michelin of France and Pirelli of Italy. Now, what Bentsen should have said at this point is, look, even with the energy tax, oil and gas are still going to be cheaper here in the U.S. than they are in France and Italy. But no, he didn't say that. In a statement accompanying details of the energy tax, he said instead that the administration would, as much as possible, encourage the cost of the tax to be passed on to consumers.
It's interesting that already the Clinton administration is trying to subvert this program, because Greenpeace put out a bulletin that indicated that this was a very progressive energy tax, that it would encourage all kinds of energy alternatives such as solar power, wind power, more efficient energy programs, that it would be an end to funding for nuclear power research and development, and that it would be generally a progressive policy that would, one, try to have a better energy system through conservation rather than dependence on oil, nuclear energy, and other polluting energy sources, and thus would be good for the environment. You recall that in 1973 there was the Arab oil embargo, and Jimmy Carter tried to develop an energy policy that would be predicated on conservation and new energy sources. But as soon as Reagan got elected, he and Bush were of course influenced by the oil lobbies, and so they just killed all the alternative energy programs and made us totally dependent on oil and gas and nuclear power for our energy needs. And it appears that Bentsen and these people are trying to push the same agenda.
You know, this consumption tax, they can call it that, but it's really a value-added tax, which they excoriated Jerry Brown for proposing during the his campaign. What it is, a tax at the, basically a tax at the source, which keeps snowballing down the line until the consumers will pick up the whole tab when they buy the product. So it's another indication that Clinton is soaking it to the middle class and the poor and letting the rich and the wealthy off.
A presidential address. From New York, here is Dan Rather.
The President of the United States is about to address the nation from the Oval Office. Here now is the question.
Our military commander basic total rock for America. And I repeat those well-known words over and over again. We will rock you. And I repeat this over and over again. Over and over again. And I repeat this over and over again. Over and over again. We will rock you. Some may ask, why rock out now? The answer is clear. The facts are clear. The answer is clear.
That's why
I have three articles here on Clinton and the tax bite, etc. One from the Z Magazine by James Petras, and another from the Left Business Observer. And it talks about the tax bite, who's going to pay and all. And then there's another article in Liberal Opinion Week, and it has something by Lars Eric Nelson. Well, let's take the Z Magazine article first. It talks about what Clinton was saying before the election compared to now. Of course, he said he was going to have a tax break for the middle class. You know, that was a lie. And he was going to have a big chunk of deficit spending to put people back to work, and that's whittled down to the point where it's a lie also. And the regressive taxes, Petras says, on energy use and the tax on Social Security earnings of $25,000, which would be paid mostly by wage earners and pensioners, this amounts to $100.7 billion a year for the next 4 years. Now, the higher income tax on the rich is supposed to bring in $126 billion in the next 4 years. However, this is going to be highly inflated estimate, because the rich and their tax accountants are already looking toward ways of getting around it. They can find loopholes. They have deferred income they can use. They can find tax shelters. And so the increase in the tax rate certainly isn't going to produce that much income. Now, Clinton's saying that he's going to increase the tax rate on the rich from a piddling amount, 31 or 32, up to 36, will still leave the tax rate on the rich very much below what it was in the early 80s, and just a fraction of what it was back in the 60s and 70s. You remember back in the 60s, the top tax rate on the very rich was 91%. And between 1964 and 1980, it was 70%. And between 80 and 86, the first Reagan presidency, it was 50%. And then during the second Reagan presidency and under Bush, it dropped to 32%. So Clinton's tax increase on the wealthy doesn't even recover the progressive tax rate of the early 80s, much less the 60s and 70s. But it continues to increase the tax inequities of the Reagan-Bush period. And in addition to that, the new bill will enable the wealthy to write off losses from real estate under more generous terms that existed under the Bush administration, if that can be imagined. Well, the Left Business Observer says, well, we can get to the rich after all, and here's what we can get from them. The 10% of the top wage earners and income earners, they're ripe for the picking, according to this. It says increasing their tax rates from 4 percentage points on $85,000 households to 20 points on $500,000 tax holds, that would yield $250 billion. And the restoring of corporate tax rates to the 1950s levels could bring in another $50 to $100 billion. Such measures would cut in half the deficit and finance a vigorous $100 billion investment program. That doesn't sound bad at all, does it? Then Lars Eric Nelson says, well, the wealthy really aren't being hurt much at all. For instance, he takes a family that are moderately wealthy, $130,000 a year, although some people consider that middle class now. But anyway, their total federal tax bill last year was $26,000 and change. And under Clinton's new plan, their federal income taxes will increase not a bit. An identical family earning $190,000, the federal income taxes would have been $46,155, but under Clinton's plan, their taxes go up $13.57 a week. And a family with over $200,000 will be paying about $35,000 a year less per year in income taxes than it would have paid in 1980 before the Reagan tax cuts took hold. So the wealthy and the upper middle class, they're not being hurt. They're not being hurt. They control the system.
Today you read the news, oh boy, and everything seems so confused, oh boy. Helpless, hopeless, heartless, so it seems. Someone's trampling on your precious dreams. Dream. If you can't lay on the
it's the color of your mind.
This is your world.
It ain't the color of your skin. It's the color of your money.
In These Times has an excellent article on the Christian right in their recent issue in February. According to In These Times, the resurgent Christian right would stun the nation by declaring a religious war at last year's Republican National Convention, wants to control the Republican National Committee by 1996. Led by Pat Robertson's Christian Coalition, the Christian right has so far controlled, taken over a dozen state GOP committees, including Texas, Louisiana, Virginia, Kansas, Washington, and Iowa. Pat Robertson's religious right has supplanted the moral majority now as the major right-wing force in both religion and politics. As for religion, the apolitical religious right associated with TV evangelicists Jim and Tammy Baker, Jimmy Swaggart, etc., has pretty much lost all of its influence. These folks believed that things of the world were of Satan and talked about renouncing political activity and simply not being concerned with the things of the world until Jesus returns. Pat Robertson, however, and his Christian coalition believe that there's a political mission for the church, that they have the mandate to build the kingdom of God and to do battle with Satan. What they've been doing is trying to take over certain local legislatures, trying to elect members to school boards, city councils, state legislatures, and focusing on local politics. They're trying to fight the liberal and satanic elements in on the local level, and they're gearing up for the next presidential election and to also gain power both in a state, local, and a national level.
Doug, their tactics seem to be to just go after these small local elections because they say they don't have to worry about convincing a majority of Americans to agree with them. They go after these elections where there is a lot of apathy, very little interest of the people, so that, as they say, one spokesman for the Christian Coalition said only about 60% of those eligible are actually registered, even in a presidential year. And only 30% of the eligible voters actually vote. Therefore, 15% of the eligible voters determine the outcome. Now, when you get further down the electoral ladder from the federal to state and local races, the percentage of participation decreases to the point where 6 or 7% of the eligible voters can determine the outcome. So this is what they emphasize, and they can just flood a local election with their people, and they can win.
And they've taken over a lot of school boards. They've won a lot of local elections. The one example of what happened when they took over a school board was they were accusing certain textbooks of being satanic, of promoting witchcraft, and of eliminating these more liberal textbooks with these theological arguments. They've also gotten together these voters' guides, which is how they try to influence the electorate, the Christian electorate in particular, in these elections. During the 1992 presidential campaign, they put together a voter guide distributing 40 million of them that had one half page comparing the records of Bush and Clinton on certain issues that made Clinton pro-abortion, pro-homosexual rights, for condom distributions in the schools, against the Christian religion, etc. In a very oversimplified fashion, they tried to equate Clinton and the Democrats with satanic, anti-religious positions, and the Republicans with more religious ones. Randall Terry, who's the head of Operation Rescue, that's a very militant anti-abortion group, also wrote a letter to 37,000 churches in October arguing that to vote for Bill Clinton is to sin against God. So this is the tactics that they are using. Now, the other point is they're trying to take over the Republican Party, that they've already taken over some state Republican committees, and they're going for the National Committee in 1996. And there's some really wild things that they've been doing in the states. For instance, in Texas, a fellow named Stephen Hoxha was elected as head of the GOP in that state. And he is associated with groups that want to Christianize America by taking over the government, beginning with city councils and county sheriff offices. Once in power, they want to establish county militias. And they also are gearing up in Texas to fight a future communistic Mexico that will march across the Rio Grande. They say that the federal government can't be trusted to do that job, so the state militia has to be organized to do it. They also seek, among other things, to abolish the public schools, the IRS, and the Federal Reserve by the year 2000. They also were the ones that helped elect Jesse Helms to the Senate in North Carolina by distributing 750,000 voters' guides through churches just before the election. This is one of their strategies. They get their literature into all the Christian right-wing churches in the area and distribute them in church to associate their political position with God, with religion, etc. And they're also very good at direct mailing campaigns. They're trying to associate to establish the biggest voter list in the country. So these are pretty serious folks. Yeah. That have a sophisticated strategy and a very definite agenda, although there are also obviously fringe elements who have some pretty crazy ideas.
Well, they also are very good at phone banks. In the Jesse Helms thing, they set up that they called 30,000 people to try to support Jesse Helms, and Helms won this just by a tiny bit. So it's obvious that these people put him over the top. But the interesting thing about their tactics are twofold. Once I have some relatives out in California, they consider themselves moderates now because they're Reagan Democrats or Reagan Republicans. But these right-wingers are using FBI and McCarthyite tactics. They're even going to the workplace and starting rumors and even trying to get these moderate Republicans fired from their jobs. They're doing everything they can to root them out of the Democratic Party and also take over the local and state Republican Party offices. But there's another very fascinating thing about this. They call them their stealth tactics. What they do is to be very quiet, don't get publicity. They refuse to do interviews with the press and do this all just within their own organization. The stealth tactics go to extreme, make extreme positions with their leaders. They say, for instance, that they don't even communicate with people outside of their organizations. They don't want even the general public to know that there's an election going on. And there was another quote that said, "I want to be invisible." And he said, "I paint my face and travel tonight. You don't know it's over until you're in a body bag. You won't know until election night." And somebody else said, "The press had no idea what we were doing when we pulled off this election." He said, "And they still don't know what we were doing." So this is a very, very covert type of operation, and it's working. As they said, well, they're very motivated. They said, "We have a plan to take our entire educational system back and put it in God's hands." And Pat Robertson said, "The battle to regain the soul of America won't be pleasant, but we will win it." Boy, these people, not only are they scary, they're vicious. They're really vicious.
Well, their other strategy is to take control of as much media as they can, to use all of the different media to get their message across. Now, they're very worried about this abortion issue because Clinton had signed some mandates the first couple days in office allowing for federally funded family planning clinics, allowing for the importation of different birth control drugs, making abortion easier, and authorizing fetal tissue research. So they've vowed a holy war on this issue to attack Clinton on this. They've also begun to get several law firms to protect the civil rights of persecuted Christians. A lot of the anti-abortion folks have been getting very vicious in their tactics. In fact, they killed a doctor in Florida, and they're regularly breaking the law to try to break abortion clinics or to block their operations. And the Christian right has several law firms that will defend them free of charge, showing again that they're very serious. Well, Robinson concluded with some remarks on the question of gays in the military, and needless to say, he was totally against it, saying, "Instead of compelling the armed forces to accept homosexuals, I would call on the president to take a stand against the ungodly lifestyle that destroys all that it touches."
Pat Robertson looks like a kindly, you know, kindly uncle, you know, soft-spoken person on television. But some of these quotes, I don't know where they got him, but he says, for instance, "The feminist agenda is not about equal rights for women. It's about socialist anti-family political movement that encourages women to leave their husbands, kill their children, practice witchcraft, destroy capitalism, and become lesbians."
This guy's a little unbalanced, I think.
Oh, wow. Then he said our strategy should, against the American radical left, which he says of the Communist Party, the ACLU, the National Council of Churches, those poor Lutherans and Methodists and Presbyterians, you know, they're all the radical left. We said we'd do the same thing that MacArthur did to the Japanese. We bypass their strongholds, then we surround them, isolate them, bombard them, then blast the individuals out of their bunkers with hand-to-hand combat.
This is scary.
Yeah, they're crazy. You know, people think they're crazy and just laugh at them, but these people are very serious, and as Kate Cornell says, they're digging in for the long haul.
In the quiet desert of southern Nevada, there are the rumblings of discontent. Our tax dollars are being spent on the most deadly threat to humanity in the history of civilization. This land was granted to the Western Shoshone Indians in a treaty with the United States government in 1863. Since 1951, our government has been testing nuclear weapons in the middle of Shoshone land. The Nevada test site, under the direction of the Department of Energy, spends millions of dollars every month to conduct underground nuclear tests. There is growing opposition from American citizens who ask, why do we need to continue to test these deadly weapons?
Nuclear testing is really done as a window dressing operation. I've spoken to nuclear scientists. They don't need to test any more. They've got enough knowledge to make all the nuclear warheads they ever want to make for the rest of time, if that's what they so desire. It's done as a public relations operation so that the Congress will keep appropriating weapons money to the labs, Lawrence Livermore, Los Alamos, Sandia Labs, to keep building and manufacturing their weapons. It's really got nothing to do with scientific expertise except a little bit for Star Wars. And Star Wars is crazy anyway because it will be hydrogen bombs circling the globe. And that is, I mean, if anything's insane, that's totally insane.
Dr. Helen Caldicott, a well-known Australian physician and outspoken opponent of nuclear weapons, has traveled all over the world speaking in communities about the senselessness of nuclear development.
I predict that nuclear weapons will be eliminated within 10 years bilaterally. Because there's no rationale to have them anymore. There never was, but there isn't now. So the weapons testing is just a public relations exercise. It must be stopped because it is polluting that area and the area of the native Indian population, and it's obscene.
Some of the most prominent opposition to nuclear weapons testing comes from those people who live downwind of the Nevada test site. People who live downwind are those most exposed to dangerous and deadly levels of radiation. The Western Shoshone Nation has stepped forward as active opponents to nuclear testing, as well as continuing to fight for their land rights.
The reason the Shoshone are here protesting it is the fact it is hazardous to people's health, and we want to see this testing stopped here. We should have been here long ago, in 51, when they were declared a test site and had protested at that time, but we didn't really have any say into the matter at that point. So we started fighting the government over the land issues, and then we felt we better do something down there at the test site to stop the testing, because what's going on there is hazardous to all our brothers and sisters, and we don't feel that needs to continue. One of my jobs is to come down here at the test site and issue permits for people to be on our land whenever they come out here to demonstrate. And we started doing this in 1987, in January, and since we started this, they've been dropping the cases against most demonstrators that were cited for trespass.
In November of 1991, a demonstration took place at the entrance to the Nevada test site. On Veterans Day weekend, veterans from around the country gathered in solidarity to protest the continued testing of nuclear weapons. There were World War II veterans, veterans of the Korean War, vets from Vietnam, and even some from the Persian Gulf War. The Alliance of Atomic Veterans organized the event with the permission of the Shoshone. These veterans were exposed to radiation while serving their country. They were not told of the harm that could come to them by exposure to these deadly weapons.
There not, just aren't that many atomic veterans alive today.
Anthony Garisco, a veteran from World War II and Korea, recalls his experience in the United States military.
Well, I was at Operation Crossroads in 1946, which was the first tests that were conducted after World War II. And that operation took place at Bikini Atoll in the Marshall Islands. And what we were doing there was we were told we were testing the effects of nuclear weapons on approximately 100 naval vessels of all different types and description, including submarines and aircraft carriers and battleships. So my experience with nuclear weapons was at the age of 19 at Operation Crossroads. 2 days after the second detonation, which was 3 weeks after the first atmospheric test, which took place in July of 1946, I became violently ill. I really thought that what I was suffering from was a bout with influenza. The symptoms were very similar. I had a high fever, was very sick, felt very weak. I was vomiting, I had diarrhea, but I had something else too. I had a rash that was completely broke out all over my body, predominantly on my top torso and my back, and I was also urinating blood. I wasn't the only one that was doing that. There was others on my ship that were the same way. And we thought that what we were experiencing was about with influenza, because no one had told us that anything could happen to us. In fact, we were told just the opposite, you know, don't worry about nothing, you know, and just all you have to do is be where we tell you to be, and you know, you'll be perfectly safe. But it wasn't quite that way. We could hear over the loudspeaker the countdown from the pilot who was piloting the this bomber that had this atomic bomb on it, and when the countdown got to zero, I just wasn't quite prepared for what I experienced. Everything became very red. I felt the heat on my back. Felt like my back of my head was burning, and we were told we could stand up and observe the bomb, which I did. And when I turned around and looked, and I seen this explosion, which seemed like it was never ending the way it was growing. I'd been in the Pacific during World War II, and I'd seen a lot of explosions. But I was never quite prepared for what I was viewing at that time. It just kept getting larger and larger and all different colors, and we could actually see the electricity dancing on the top of it. And we were not looking at a faraway distance. We were looking almost straight up at it. So being between 6.5 and 7 miles away, when I look back at it now, it was really insane. And truly it came home to me what happened at Hiroshima and what happened at Nagasaki. And I could understand how 50,000 people could die in 1.5 seconds. It changed my whole life for me. I became very aware that I had taken part in moving the military by my presence as a warrior to the position where the U.S. military could do this. And I was appalled. It was strictly experimentation. And it took me a long time to get over that. I had to live with that because I felt that my participation in the military had caused that, and it did, because I helped them to get that far. I went in the military thinking that I was protecting my country.
Many veterans gathered at the gates of the test site on the day before the national holiday. Several people were arrested, including vets, for trespassing onto government property. On Veterans Day, they chose not to get arrested so as not to give away their power to the government once again.
Then how about the U.S. military that took 250,000 patriots like myself, who had just got through fighting in Vietnam, in Korea, in World War II, took us out here to this place over here, and dropped and exploded nuclear weapons over us. 250,000, and then turned their back on us after that. Didn't want anything to do with us. Lied and lied for years and years, and passed on a conspiracy from one administration to another to not recognize the veterans, the patriots, that put their life on the line for this country, and the payment for that was to take us over here and lay us on the altar of the atomic age as nothing more than sacrificial lambs to develop the nuclear weapons that today hold each of us hostage. It's proven over and over that if you tell people the big lie and stay with it, they'll buy it. Because, you know, we're all patriots. We all want to respect our country. We want to respect our leaders. But the fact is, we're number one. We got over 300,000 homeless veterans. We got over 75,000 people sleeping on the streets of New York this winter. 25% of all the homeless people are children. And so, you know, you want to talk about number one. If they're honest, why don't they talk about that? Why don't they talk about the children that can't read? These are the people, the children that we depend on to take over our country.
And millions that we could be. How long can you hear someone crying? How long can you hear someone dying before you ask yourself why? And how long will we hear people speaking about missiles for peace and just let it go by? How long will they tell us these weapons are keeping us weak? It's a lie. How long?
Nuclear weapons testing affects everyone on Earth. Our government continues testing while the overwhelming majority of Americans still don't realize testing is taking place.
What we're hearing now is safety. We have to test for safety. What could be more dangerous than exploding a nuclear weapon? Absolutely nothing. There is absolutely no justification. Yet the Reagan-Bush
Jackie Cabasso, a lifelong anti-nuclear activist, traveled to the Soviet Union in 1991. She traveled to Kazakhstan, where the Soviets used to test nuclear weapons. As a result of a massive grassroots campaign from people of that region, they were able to put an end to nuclear weapons testing in their country.
I believe that I can speak for the vast majority of the people in Kazakhstan. When I think the message they would want to deliver here is twofold. One is, we stopped testing. Now it's your turn. The second is, we're with you. You're not alone. And I think the most important message I want to deliver here today is that we are not alone. In this country, in the last 20 years or so, unfortunately, we peace-loving people, we people who honor the earth and try to protect the earth, we people who put human need above military dominance have been relegated to some sort of fringe category. Somehow we're not considered part of the mainstream. And what I want to tell you all is that we are part of the global mainstream. We are the global majority. We are part of the global anti-nuclear alliance. And it is our job to convey that message to our supposed leaders.
The American people must take back their country as the Soviet people have done. The United States has sort of worked its way into a corner in terms of the economy, and that's partly why its debt is $3.5 trillion at the moment, its external debt, which is an unbelievable amount of money. And the only reason it's still surviving is that Japan maintains the United States foreign debt. And one of the main reasons this has all happened is because it got on the wrong track after the Second World War, partly at the instigation of General Electric and other corporations, to manufacture weapons instead of things that people can buy, sell, eat, and sleep in. It's the United States that's holding back. So the answer comes straight back to this, the heart of this country. Are you going to disarm? Don't blame anyone else. People in glass houses can't throw stones.
In a rare interview with Corbin Harney, the spiritual leader of the Western Shoshone, we are given a feeling of what the struggle has been for his people. He is the last member of his tribe to know the ancient native tongue and sacred songs of his ancestors.
As a native people, the law don't protect us. They say the law protects us, but the law hasn't been shown me as one individual. never done nothing for me. All it did was take my rights away from me. They should be protecting the earth. They should be protecting the water. Like they always say, we're to protecting your thing for you. But at the same time, they want to take it away from me. And I think that's not the way it should be. I suffer from all those things. It makes me feel bad to talk about those things. But what can I do as one individual? Here it comes to my eyes every now and then. It's really bad. I don't like to see those things happening. Our life's been here ruined by the chemicals. Mining company using the weapon that they're developing here is ruining our health. I don't like to see that. All my animal friends today are suffering. They don't know what to do, but they are looking at us, looking our way, saying we need your help. We like to continue our life too. Same with the birds. Birds are saying the same thing. We like to have a healthy life. We like to have a healthy air that we can fly in. All our rocks today suffer. I see that in the sweats here, and I see it all over. The life in that rock is beginning. The spirit in the rocks begin to die out. And I think that's wrong for the United States government to do to the people, to our planet life. We only got one planet floating around out here. We only got one water. The water's the same around the world. The air is the same around the world. Everybody breathes this air. Everybody drinks that water. Today, we all use it around the globe, around the world. We all use it, this land. So it feeds us. It does a lot of good things for us. Let's unite together and help our Mother Earth. So it'll help us to live a healthier life. That's all I can say to you people. I hope you people can carry that message on out. We unite ourselves together so we be happy people again. So all the plant life be happier to see us. That's what I think I like to see, is people be together.
We have an opportunity at this point in the history of humanity. After having spent approximately $12 trillion on the arms race with Moscow, we can now choose to stop spending money and valuable technical expertise to develop and test the most deadly weapons ever known to mankind. As the tests go on and the radiation continues to vent into the atmosphere and filter into the groundwater, we threaten the future of our children and all life on planet Earth. We are all subject to the effects of radiation. We are all victims of the cost of weapons testing. In the final analysis, we are all downwinders. Exercise your patriotic rights as American citizens by letting your government know that you want a peaceful and healthy planet for your children to inherit.
Yeah!
ultimate peril posed by nuclear weapons is the extinction of mankind. When the last act is played out, there will be no one left to see it. And that's Alternative Views for this time. We'd like to thank Tim Hanlon for letting us use his video by Calvin Russell, This Is Your World, and also arranging to let us use the Emergency Broadcast Network's We Will Rock You. And to Maureen McGarry for letting us use her documentary, We Are All Downwinder. Goodbye.